Good day, everyone. This is Ed, Talking Information Center of the Massachusetts Radio Network, bringing you articles from The American Spectator magazine and some other journals. We will lead off this week with a continuation article from prior week entitled The Foreign Policy Establishment Plans for a Post-Trump World. So if you wish to, you go back to the archives, and you'll be able to, from last week, and you'll be able to read this article, which was the last article. We got about halfway through it, and now we will continue it. Liana Fix characterizes the current international scene as one of the transition and disruption, and claims that Trump administration is retreating from Europe, but she believes that Europe can provide for its own non-nuclear security. She is less critical of Trump than most of the other contributors, noting that a Europe that is stronger militarily, economically, and technologically serves U.S. interests, even if it acts increasingly on its own. Fix's views are echoed by Matthias Matschitz, who contends that the U.S.-Europe alliance relationship will have to become more reciprocal, more selective, and more grounded in capabilities because the old model of asymmetric dependence is no longer politically sustainable. The U.S., he writes, will remain the anchor of European security, but Europeans will do far more. I think Trump would agree. Stephen A. Cook actually gives Trump credit for recognizing the changes in the security architecture in the Middle East, especially the more prominent role played by the Gulf states. And he recognizes that Trump regards the Middle East, except for an Iranian nuclear threat, as less important to U.S. security than the Indo-Pacific. Will Freeman, on the other hand, accuses Trump of playing a mostly coercive hand in Latin America that may result in short-term gains but will not likely restore lost influence across much of South America. Freeman appears to view Trump's attempt to consolidate hemispheric security as counterproductive and at least ineffectual. Michelle Gavin, who served as U.S. Ambassador to Botswana and U.S. Representative to South African Development Community during the Obama administration, accuses the Trump administration of having an anachronistic and dismissive ideas about Africa, which, if not changed, will prevent the U.S. from competing with other powers, i.e. China, for influence in Africa. Edward Fishman, who served in the State Department under John Kerry during the Obama administration, writes about geopolitics and scolds the Trump administration for waging economic warfare against adversaries and allies alike, which has eroded trust within the Western economic bloc that won the Cold War and is leading to economic fragmentation. Another Obama State Department official, Heidi Crabo Redeker, blames Trump for damaging alliances and weakening institutions and erasing the line between economic policy and national security. Trump's more nationalist posture, she states, has called into question whether the U.S. is bound by the norms and values as long demanded that others respect. The next administration, she writes, will need to rebuild trust and restore respect for multilateral institutions. Biden administration official Brad Setzer criticizes Trump for weaponizing trade by using tariffs to compel U.S. trading partners to accept unequal terms. The next president, Setzer contends, will need to birth a new economic order. Ben Stale accuses Trump of undermining the multilateral trading system that emerged from the aftermath of World War II and calls for a revival, even on a smaller scale, of multilateralism. Alice Hill, who served on Obama's National Security Council and in the Department of Homeland Security, criticizes Trump for ignoring the threat posed by climate change. Biden national security official Rosh Doshi writes that Trump has ruptured U.S. alliances, which he views as our greatest asset and a strategy to balance China. The next administration, Doshi says, will need to rebuild trust and credibility that Trump squandered. Trump, he writes, by acting alone, has made it more difficult to balance China. Stuart Reed believes Trump is being unrealistic in trying to divide Russia from China because, unlike in the 1970s, there is not a split to exploit the way Nixon did. The best we can do, Reed believes, is to strengthen our alliances to combat the Sino-Russian axis. And Trump has weakened, not strengthened, our alliances, according to Reed. Max Boot, another neocon whose past misjudgments about U.S. military strategy should give pause to anyone who reads what he writes about war and strategy, is pro-Ukrainian war and seemingly pro-Iran war, but faults Trump for lacking a strategy designed to translate military victories into desired political outcomes. Arent Dumbacher, another Biden official, seems to blame Trump for everything that is wrong in the world. Trump, she writes, has lost the trust of U.S. allies and squandered U.S. global leadership. She accuses the Trump administration of causing hundreds of thousands of deaths in the global south, ceding the moral high ground to China. There is a sprinkling of essays in CFR's first installment. Just an author's note here, or an announcer's note. The CFR is the Council on Foreign Relations, and they're writing all of these things in the Future of American Strategy Initiatives. Next up, author J.T. Young writes, "Meet the post-Biden Democrats." Biden's Democrats. Despite being desperate to put Biden behind them, Democrats can't do it. Both Kamala Harris and Pete Buttigieg are routinely topping Democratic primary polling, and both are defined by Biden. Last Thursday, May 28th, two Democratic 2028 presidential polls came out. In a big data poll, taken May 24 to 27, Kamala Harris led by 13 percentage points. In Emerson College polling, taken May 23 to 24, Pete Buttigieg led by 2 percentage points. Let the irony of these results sink in. These people lost to Biden among Democrats in 2020, and then Democrats pushed out Biden in 24. The DNC's recent botched release of its ultimately disavowed report on Democrats' 2024 roadkill of a campaign served to inflame the entire party. However, there was one point of unifying agreement: that party needs to put 2024 behind them. This is understandable. 2024 saw them outspend Republicans by almost $1 billion and lose the popular vote for the first time in 20 years. Skip back to last Thursday's poll results, and the two highest political qualifications of the people topping each poll were having served in the failed Biden administration. This is where they're turning for their 2028 frontrunners. This is not a partisan verdict, but the American people's opinion from November of 24. Re-election campaigns are always a referendum on the party holding power. Democrats held the presidency in 24. Democrats lost the referendum on their time in the White House by over 2 million popular votes, 86 electoral votes, and in every swing state. This is also the verdict of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. You don't have an autopsy unless somebody died. And in 2024, what died was Kamala Harris and the Democrats' campaign. And it is the verdict of Democratic leaders as well. Former Representative Barney Frank, Democrat Massachusetts, Senator John Fetterman, Democrat Pennsylvania, and strategist James Carville and many more. The Biden administration in November 2024 were unmitigated disasters for Democrats, yet now, coming on 2 years after the fact, this is where they're turning for their frontrunners? Democrats want 2028 to be all about Donald Trump, even though he will not be on the ballot. Yet, these two early polls show the Democrats are considering putting Biden, or at least his surrogates, on the ballot. To take the irony a step further, consider what qualified both Harris and Buttigieg for the selection for the Biden administration. They both lost to Biden in the Democratic primaries badly. Kamala Harris had been a national disaster for Democrats since throwing her hat into the 2020 Democratic priority chase, seeking the 2020 Democratic nomination, sharing the 2020 ticket in the Biden-Harris administration for 4 years as the 2024 Democratic nominee and since leaving office. Harris dropped out of the 2020 primary contest in 2019. Her campaign was derided. Once in office, she was labeled as a failure as vice president. Only after Biden was forced out was she finagled in at the last minute, without primaries, without winning delegates, and with no chance that she would fail within her own party. Again, Pete Buttigieg was almost equally inept. He flamed out in 2020. He won a grand total of 21 delegates in the Democratic primaries, finishing fifth behind Biden, Sanders, Warren, and Bloomberg. Buttigieg was made Secretary of the Department of Transportation for his efforts, hardly a top assignment. He held the position throughout the administration. Now, name one thing he did. For that matter, name one former Department of Transportation Secretary of any administration. Buttigieg was a nonentity in a failed administration after having lost badly to Biden in the primaries. That's his national resume. Only Democrats could see such resumes as strengths. They want and desperately need to get past 2024 to win in 2028. Yet among their 2028 frontrunners are the two architects of 2024. And what qualified for them for their past administration service and their current 2028 aspirations? Losing to Biden. Just to make the chain of failure unmistakably clear, Democrats rejected Harris and Buttigieg in 2020, choosing Biden instead. Both Harris and Buttigieg received places in a Biden administration, which the American people deemed to be a resounding failure. Then Democrats pushed Biden off their ticket in 24. It's like a nesting doll of failure, each enclosed within the next. The next presidential election is not until November of 28. 2.5 years is a long time. However, Democrats' fascination with Harris and Buttigieg shows they have an even longer way to go and that they have no clue on how to get there. Next up, the ballot is not a compliance form. The author is Greg Maresca. In an era saturated with identity markers, qualifiers, and classifications, the voting booth used to stand as a last refuge of simplicity. A name, a party, a choice. That was enough. Not anymore. When I voted in this year's Pennsylvania primary, I noticed something new. Candidates for the Republican State Committee were listed not just by name, but by gender. It was a first, and hopefully not the beginning of a trend where the ballot becomes a biography. A party official in Harrisburg explained that the inclusion of gender reflects national GOP bylaws requiring equal representation of men and women among convention delegates. Since the ballot is the mechanism for selecting those delegates, voters need that information to produce the proper mix to ensure those numbers come out right. What looks like a ballot is now doubling as a compliance form. That may satisfy party procedures, but misses the larger point. The ballot is supposed to serve voters, not bylaws. Elections are meant to be about ideas, policies, and competence, not personal characteristics that have little bearing on a candidate's ability to serve. Adding gender does not clarify anything about how a candidate will govern. Rather, it nudges voters, however unintentionally, to weigh identity before qualifications. This is not progress, but mission creep and an unneeded diversion. There may be average voting differences between genders, but gender does not determine a person's votes, policy preferences, or judgments. It just satisfies a quota. What about candidates who do not answer to male or female? Does the ballot then become a place for expanding identity descriptors rather than streamlining choice? If gender is included, why not age, race, professional background, educational credentials, charitable donations, or one's favorite college football team? The ballot could quickly transform into a straightforward decision tool from a tool of personal attributes resembling another campaign advertisement. Voting is supposed to be the great equalizer. When a citizen steps up to vote, every candidate should stand on equal footing. Highlighting gender, even for procedural reasons, suggests gender is politically relevant. A similar ballot respects voter autonomy. It allows citizens to bring their own values, priorities, and judgment into the process without subtle cues directing them. Make no mistake, presentation influences perception, as even well-intentioned additions can carry unintended influence. even when it pretends not to. Well-intentioned additions can shape outcomes. There are reasons simple systems endure. Just like ink signatures, handshakes, and a notary stamp, paper ballots with a name and party affiliation have worked since the early days of the American Republic. They are clear, accessible, and easy to understand across educational and cultural lines. Adding layers of unnecessary information may help satisfy political bylaws, but complexity does not always equal improvement and rarely stays contained. Rather, it invites confusion, controversy, and the inevitable required-by-law addition. The ballot is not a compliance form for political parties to help sort their delicate histrionics. Rather, it is a means of translating the will of the voter into a clear choice. The more we complicate the ballot with secondary considerations, the further we dilute its purpose and turn it into a script for how you are supposed to vote. Andrew Langer is our next author. He writes, "The View's Joy Behar is furious that Trump RX is lowering drug costs." One day, historians may look back at The View and conclude the program functioned less as political commentary and more as accidental satire. That conclusion became even more plausible last week after co-host Joy Behar suggested Americans could effectively die because President Trump is attempting to lower prescription drug costs through the Trump RX program. Yes, lower drug prices are apparently now dangerous. The outrage followed the administration's announcement that roughly 600 additional generic medications would be added to the Trump RX initiative, expanding access to lower-cost purchasing options for millions of Americans. The administration estimates the broader effort could save consumers and seniors hundreds of billions of dollars over the next decade. For years, Americans have heard celebrities, progressive activists, and Democratic politicians insist that high prescription drug costs represent one of the country's great moral failures. Entire campaigns were built around the idea that seniors were rationing medicine while pharmaceutical costs spiraled out of control. But now that a Republican administration is pursuing a more market-oriented strategy aimed at reducing prices without fully federalizing health care, many of those same voices suddenly sound horrified. Apparently, lowering drug costs is only admirable when it arrives wrapped inside a massive government expansion program inside by the correct political party. To be fair, policymakers should approach any pharmaceutical pricing framework cautiously, whether proposed by Republicans or Democrats. Heavy-handed government intervention in drug pricing can produce serious long-term consequences, including reduced research investment, supply distortions, diminished innovation, and fewer breakthrough therapies over time. These concerns are real. They deserve serious discussion. But that is precisely why the current reaction from much of the media and progressive political world is so revealing. Trump RX, whatever its imperfections, is still clearly addressing affordability concerns through expanded generic access, pricing transparency, and efforts to reduce the influence of opaque intermediary structures that have distorted healthcare market for years. That matters because much of the frustration consumers experience today does not stem solely from pharmaceutical innovation itself, but the bloated architecture surrounding prescription drug distribution and reimbursement. For decades, Americans have been trapped inside a labyrinth of pharmacy benefit managers, rebate systems, opaque pricing arrangements, formulary negotiations, and administrative middlemen that often leave patients paying artificially inflated prices while large institutional players profit handsomely behind the scenes. Reducing those distortions should not be controversial. Yet on programs like The View, market-oriented healthcare reforms are frequently treated as morally suspect, while centralized government control is portrayed as enlightened compassion. When Bernie Sanders appeared on the program advocating government-run healthcare systems, the hosts responded with near enthusiasm. Missing from those conversations were many of the difficult realities that accompany heavy centralized healthcare systems around the world. There was little discussion of lengthy specialist wait times in countries like Canada and the United Kingdom, where bureaucratic cost management decisions routinely shape patient access to care. There was little discussion of rationing pressures, delayed treatments, or the trade-offs that emerge when governments become the dominant purchasers and price setters within healthcare systems. Nor was there much discussion of the deeply troubling controversies surrounding medically assisted dying policies in Canada, including reports that vulnerable patients were at times steered towards euthanasia discussions amid broader system strains and resource pressures. These realities do not mean America should ignore affordability concerns. They do, however, illustrate why policymakers must be careful not to confuse healthcare reform with ever-expanding government control. Innovation and affordability do not have to be enemies. The United States continues to lead the world in pharmaceutical development because our system, despite its flaws, still rewards scientific risk-taking, capital investment, and medical innovation. Many of the world's most important breakthrough therapies were developed precisely because companies had incentives to invest billions of dollars into uncertain research and development efforts. At the same time, Americans are entirely justified in demanding greater transparency, lower out-of-pocket costs, and more competitive pricing structures. The challenge is achieving those goals without replacing one distorted system with another. This is where TrumpRx represents a meaningful shift in the right direction. Rather than relying exclusively on centralized price controls or sweeping government management of healthcare delivery, the initiative attempts to increase competition, expand generic access, improve price visibility, and weaken the grip of entrenched intermediary structures. Is it perfect? Of course not. Policymakers should remain vigilant to ensure that short-term political pressure to reduce prices does not gradually evolve into counterproductive government coercion that ultimately undermines pharmaceutical innovation and the long-term patient access. Any administration, Republican or Democrat, can drift too far in that direction if affordability goals become disconnected from economic reality. But treating lower drug costs as some kind of existential threat, as the host of The View effectively did this week, is both intellectually unserious and politically revealing. Americans should not have to choose between affordable medicine and continued innovation. A disciplined, market-oriented healthcare system should be capable of supporting both. That is the real debate policymakers should be having, not whether consumers deserve relief from inflated healthcare costs, but how to achieve that relief without sacrificing innovation, flexibility, and long-term resilience that makes modern medicine possible in the first place. Next up, author Itzu Diaz, writing in Law and Liberty, has From the Fourth Estate to Digital Fragmentation. The mid-20th century generation experienced the boom of journalism as an effective fourth estate and guarantor of freedoms. Contemporary generations are witnessing its death. The fourth estate, a term which Edmund Burke allegedly coined, quickly became an essential pillar of modern democracies, information that allows individuals to fully exercise their rights and defend themselves against the overwhelming power of the state. But today, it seems that journalism is declining and artificial intelligence may become the new fourth estate. But not only does AI fail to protect the individual against government power, it often reinforces the supremacy of the state. There is an enormous cultural gap between the journalistic mythomania of the front page, Billy Wilder's unforgettable masterpiece, and today's deluge of monochromatic content and news stamped with the disclaimer, content created with the help of AI. Chartbeat's latest report on audiences in the first half of 26 reveals that search engine traffic to small digital media outlets, those receiving between 1,000 and 10,000 daily page views, has fallen by 60% over the past 2 years, while search traffic to large media outlets with more than 100,000 daily visits has dropped by 22%. Publishers who are counting on AI to become their new traffic providers have already been disillusioned. It is true that visits referred from platforms like ChatGPT are increasing eightfold every year, according to SimilarWeb data, but the reality remains bleak for mainstream media. In the specific case of ChatGPT, it represents less than 0.1%, that's 0.001% of the total traffic received by newspaper and media websites. Yes, AI platforms generate traffic, but they destroy far more traffic than they generate because although they draw from the media, they offer more complete and accurate answers than conventional information, so users stop at the answers to the query and do not delve further into the sources. This feels like the end of a long road. The idea that the press was a fundamental counterweight in a democracy vanished the day journalistic side of the scale ceased to carry weight because it no longer significantly influenced public opinion. The story of how we got there, while depressing, is also fascinating because it helps us understand many things about our times and how our freedoms have been partially stolen before our very eyes. The golden age of journalism, often identified with Watergate, New Journalism, and the investigative reporting of the 80s and 90s, has not been followed by a descent into the bronze age of journalism, but rather by an age of smoke. In a way, Balzac's prophecy in Lost Illusions, written in 1843, has come true, although for reasons different from those he could have foreseen. The quote from Balzac, 1843 now, "Give any newspaper time enough, and it will be base, hypocritical, shameless, and treacherous. The periodical press will be the death of ideas, systems, and individuals. Nay, it will flourish upon their decay. It will take credit for all of the creations of the brain. The harm that it does is done anonymously." End quote. We can identify four critical movements in this decline. First, the rise of the internet and digital media led to a decline in print readership. Now, any new free digital outlet could capture attention with a major exclusive, often delivered faster, more accessible, more up-to-date, and in a richer multimedia format than legacy outlets. An army of AI-generated bots can drastically alter public opinion on social media about any hot topic in just a few hours and can prove more effective than an extensive, well-founded, exclusive report in any traditional newspaper. Second, in the midst of this process, declining print readership and subscriptions brought in a fall in advertisers, leaving many major Western newspapers in conditions of economic vulnerability, according to a Pew Research. Print advertising in the U.S. fell by more than 70% between 2005 and 2020. This led to the formation of large media groups encompassing newspapers, magazines, television channels, radio stations, and digital platforms, followed by a wave of layoffs and budget cuts. Third, social media burst into the scene just as digital outlets were beginning to understand the importance of search engine optimization, and consumption habits rapidly shifted toward these platforms. It no longer mattered how a news item ranked on the search engine results, but whether it went viral on social media, as a succession of algorithms gradually reduced the visibility of what newspapers sought to highlight, instead rewarding what users engaged with the most heavily. This degenerated into clickbait frenzy, and with it, the old written journalism we once knew effectively died, morphing into something closer to tabloid television. In any major newspaper, a celebrity in a thong on a beach generates 10 or 20 times more engagement than a major political scoop. Moreover, the thong story is 10 times cheaper to produce than serious investigative reporting or war coverage. This leaves what was once considered the powerful world of journalism in a somewhat embarrassing position. In fact, most major media outlets have removed most read news rankings from their front pages to avoid them becoming a predictable mix of bulk events, celebrity news, how-to articles, sex and emotional clickbait. Instead, they now offer reading trends, most popular or recommended stories, which allow them to apply a few quality reads filter and take another factors into account. I am not suggesting that digitization was inherently an obstacle to quality and freedom. On the contrary, the ability to access and verify information across multiple sources has expanded exponentially. The question is whether this new landscape still allows us to consider the press a true fourth estate. The case is difficult to argue when, in terms of sheer influence, that role is now more often played by influencers, YouTubers, or bots deployed by governments, pressure groups, and other interested corporations to shape online debate. The press no longer holds a monopoly on information and is frequently outpaced in both speed and scope by other channels. P.J. O'Rourke saw this early on, writing in The CEO of the Sofa, "The web is just a device by which bad ideas travel around the globe at the speed of light." X is a clear example of how the democratization of information can be both an opportunity and a threat to freedom. When Elon Musk acquired the platform in October 22, he claimed his goal was to restore free speech and end moderation policies that, de facto, amplified certain ideological messages at the expense of others. X can serve as a guarantor of free expression or as a powerful tool for manipulation by elites and governments. At different moments, it has arguably been both. On the one hand, X, Facebook, and other 21st century information platforms may suppress traditional newspapers at their peak in terms of influence over immediate political cycles, daily ideological agendas, or reputational dynamics, but they have never managed to match the long-term structural influence of traditional newspapers on public opinion as a whole. On the other hand, in 2026, we are privileged witnesses to a new paradigm shift that goes beyond social media. AI, with its amalgamation of sources and its simple, concise explanations, is rapidly gaining ground on traditional media and the role of providing information to users. And although most all chatbots offer links to their sources, as I have pointed out previously, most users do not go beyond the first level of inquiry, i.e., the text generated directly by the chatbots, and ignore the original sources. That is to say, real influence no longer lies with media groups, nor even with big tech companies that control search algorithms, but with AI, subject to whatever biases its developers choose to introduce at any given moment, as has already been widely debated and documented when analyzing the pro-woke biases of ChatGPT or Claude. To make matters worse, AI can explain a news story better than most journalists, and it certainly allows users to fully personalize their interests. We could be, in other words, thrown into a near future in which even the traditional digital press format could cease to make sense or at least become something marginal. As for print, consider the shift in the profitability model. In the era of classic journalism, ads and subscriptions were essential. Today, most share a hybrid model that includes print and its advertising, the diversification of digital content, subscriptions, and digital advertising. The print newspaper is no longer the business itself, but a small product within a much broader digital business. There is a clear parallel with the music industry. Platforms like Spotify have rendered physical media largely obsolete, leaving vinyl as a niche format for romantics and collectors. Much of traditional journalism now occupies that same space. And if this perfect storm were not enough, we must reckon with the rise of 20-second news, delivered by TikTokers, tweets, influencers, or AI-generated summaries. Audiences are no longer accustomed to reading long-form analysis. Videos steadily displaces text across platforms. Reality, compressed into just a few seconds, is far more susceptible to manipulation by individuals, organizations, or governments seeking to shape public debate. Originally, a certain degree of transparency in funding and independence was essential for press to function as a counterweight to power. Today, independence, both in large corporations and among small freelancers and influencers, is scarce and, in any case, very difficult to identify with any precision amid the vast media landscape. As has been noted, many of the new leading voices in journalistic opinion are flourishing on social media. They are often not journalists, have not worked their way up through the profession, and their funding is unknown. They simply went viral and either were absorbed by established media organizations or evolved their accounts into independent media channels in their own right. Virality often appears spontaneous. It is not always so. Many seemingly random influences are suspected of having been deliberately boosted by political actors or organizations. Some cases have come to light, sparking media scandals. For instance, Wired revealed last August that a group dedicated to promoting democratic discourse online offered influencers up to $8,000 a month to promote the party line under a confidentiality agreement and with certain restrictions on their content. In May of 25, the New York Times uncovered other similar networks through which Democrats are attempting to recruit new influencers to counter Donald Trump's dominance in the social media culture war. We cannot say that this mix of influencers, traditional media, opinions aggregated by AI chatbots, and breaking news on major social networks constitutes a fourth estate. For both suspicious and legitimate influencers, what Hunter S. Thompson once denounced still holds. This is Hunter Thompson writing many years ago. The most consistent and ultimately damaging failure of political journalism in America is that it has roots in the clubby cocktail personal relationships that inevitably develop between politicians and journalists. End quote. It is not easy to know the sources or information origin of information. As the profiles of what used to be a conventional journalists have become blurred, those who spontaneously turn to reporting do not understand the value of journalistic deontological principles or are even unaware of them. As your announcers, I'm going to put in a little insertion here. I saw the word deontological. Never read it before. And I looked it up. And deontological is a system of ethics where an action is considered morally good because of some of the characteristic of the action itself, not because the product of the action is good. Okay? So we go along here. When Roger Scruton wrote An Apology for Thinking, he was denouncing the specific case of censorship he had suffered after a decontextualized interview in The New Statesman, But as is always the case with the British philosopher, he was also denouncing the new censors who today work on the internet fabricating cancel campaigns, stating, this is from Roger Scruton, "We in Britain are entering a dangerous social condition in which the direct expression of opinions that conflict, or merely seem to conflict, with a narrow set of orthodoxies is instantly punished by a bland band of self-appointed vigilantes. We are being cowed into abject conformity around a dubious set of official doctrines and told to adopt a worldview that we cannot examine for fear of being publicly humiliated by the censors. This worldview might lead to a new and liberated social order, or it might lead to the social and spiritual destruction of our country." In short, the post-digital boom crisis in journalism has only exacerbated the early symptoms of decline that some authors detected decades ago. This is the case of H.L. Mencken, who drenched the profession, like everything else, in cynicism. And yet, in his latter years, he glimpsed the first warning signs in the major newspapers, writing, "In my day, a reporter who took on an assignment was wholly on his own until he got back to the office, and even then he was a little molested until his copy was turned in at the desk. Today, he tends to become only homunculus at the end of a telephone wire, and the reduction of his observation to prose is constantly farmed out to literary castrati who never leave the office and hence never feel the wind of the world in their faces or see anything with their own eyes." These are very old problems amplified by a new digital ecosystem. The Fourth Estate, at the very least, is now a decentralized, chaotic amalgam of loudspeakers whose fragmentation empowers the state over the citizen. This Fourth Estate is no longer led by a small number of identifiable, more or less transparent newspapers, radio stations, and television channels adhering to certain standards of journalistic ethics. Social media often delivers information from authors we know nothing about beyond an anonymous profile on X or another platform, with the sole and controversial endorsement of a large follower count. An army of AI-generated bots can drastically alter public opinion on social media about any hot topic in just a few hours, even using fake news or emotionally manipulative rhetoric, and can prove more effective than an extensive, well-founded, exclusive report in any traditional newspaper. The term Fourth Estate was once used because it referred to an identifiable, relatively homogeneous group that, despite ideological differences and partisan preferences, generally exercised its role as a counterweight to political power in a fairly consistent way. Today, we cannot say that this mix of influences, traditional media opinions, opinions aggregated by AI, chatbots, and breaking news on major social networks constitutes a Fourth Estate. Rather, in its extreme fragmentation, a mixture of truth and fake news, and lack of transparency regarding authorship or verifiable sources, it is political power that gains ground vis-a-vis dissolved and heterogeneous media landscape. Of course, at this point in the history of communications, the losers are individual freedom and the democratic health of our societies. In other words, we may now have access to vastly more information than ever before, but we're also vulnerable to manipulation by political power. Faced with the vast audience, aggregators of influences, newspapers obsessed with clickbait, and AI bots generating informational noise, what we once called old journalism, or even new journalism, in the hands of Tom Wolfe and Gay Talese, now looks set to become a refined, decorative luxury product aimed at minorities. At the very least, beyond filling the hearts of print romantics, it will serve as a reminder that freedom must be won every day. Next up, Joseph Ford Cotto, writing in American Thinker, writes, "Trump's epic fraud crackdown is America first for the midterms. In this difficult economy, when families across America are struggling to cover rising costs for food, housing, and medical care, every tax dollar must be protected. President Donald J. Trump is showing strong leadership by taking direct action to stop the massive waste and theft that has drained safety net programs for too long. His creation of the task force to eliminate fraud represents real commitment to making government work efficiently for American citizens. On March 16th, Trump signed an executive order that established this task force. Vice President J.D. Vance chairs it, the Federal Trade Commission chairman serves as vice chairman, and senior officials, including the assistant to the President for Homeland Security, provide guidance. Cabinet secretaries and agency heads participate as members. The task force coordinates a full national strategy to combat fraud, waste, and abuse in federal benefit programs covering housing, food assistance, medical care, and cash support. It improves eligibility verification, adds strong prepayment controls, identifies risky fraud patterns, and works to break up criminal networks. Agencies are required to set minimum anti-fraud standards like proper identity, proof, and documentation, while developing clear implementation plans with measurable goals. The task force reports progress frequently to Trump. This initiative is vital for keeping America internally strong. Fraud and programs steals from taxpayers and from eligible citizens who truly depend upon help. It drives up prices for essential goods, adds to the national debt, and undermines trust in government. For years, illegal aliens, criminals, foreign gangs, bureaucrats, and certain nonprofits have exploited weaknesses. Some states avoided real eligibility checks, permitted self-certification, and even refused to share data for federal review. In July of 2025, 21 states filed a lawsuit in California to block basic oversight of Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program enrollees, that's SNAP. Minnesota stands as a stark example of the damage caused by years of neglect. Medicaid fraud there could reach billions of dollars. Nearly 9% of food stamp spending is wasted in errors. The Feeding Our Future scandal stole nearly $250 million intended for needy children. Hundreds of millions in federal child care funding were taken by an organized ring involving Somali immigrants. That money brought cars, property, luxury travel, and was allegedly funneled to one of Africa's worst terror groups. State officials under Democratic leadership ignored red flags or failed to detect the problems. Critics rightfully call this an endemic scandal enabled by Governor Tim Walz and blue legislative majorities. Fake daycares, autism service scams, and child nutrition fraud exploded, with whistleblowers facing retaliation. Many credibly believe Democrats allowed it to continue to secure political support in certain immigrant communities while blocking tougher reforms and independent oversight. This failure played a major role in Walz abandoning his 2026 re-election bid. Similar risks exist in Democratic bastions of California, Illinois, New York, Maine, Colorado, due to insufficient safeguards. The Biden-Harris administration weakened protections by reducing verification requirements, expanding access without controls, and accepting high error rates that enabled widespread fraud abuse. Trump has taken the opposite approach. He made it clear the first duty of government is to protect American citizens, not illegal aliens. Starting in early 25, he signed executive orders to prevent taxpayer resources from supporting illegal immigration, to eliminate information silos that hid waste, to strengthen Treasury screening for improper payments, and to stop ineligible individuals from obtaining Social Security Act benefits. Vance announced a new National Fraud Enforcement Division at the Department of Justice in January of 26. Trump's administration has acted aggressively in Minnesota, temporarily pausing Medicaid funding to halt suspected claims during investigations. The crackdown on fraud has produced impressive early results. Nearly $260 million in Medicaid payments to Minnesota were halted over fraud allegations. Federal prosecutors charged 11 individuals in a major California real estate and loan fraud ring targeting elderly Americans. High-risk hospice and home health care providers were suspended in the Los Angeles area. A national whistleblower program was launched to help Americans report abuse. Additional suspensions hit dozens more providers, with charges in a $50 million hospice scheme and a guilty plea on $270 million in false claims. The Justice Department reported 8,000 active fraud cases. The task force uncovered $6.3 billion in suspected fraudulent contracts and started sweeping investigations. In Los Angeles, 447 hospices and 23 home health agencies were suspended, with estimated fraud over $600 million. Criminal warrants targeted 20 Minnesota businesses for SNAP fraud. The new National Fraud Enforcement Division took action on schemes worth over $340 million in its first week. The Small Business Administration referred 562,000 fraudulent pandemic loans totaling $22 billion for collection. Enforcement operations, that's 562 fraudulent pandemic loans, $22 billion. Enforcement operations hit nearly two dozen Minnesota child care centers. A West Coast strike force was formed for health care fraud. Additional Medicaid funds were deferred from non-cooperating Minnesota. Over 10,000 suspected fraud cases were identified in immigration student work programs. Nationwide, $1.4 billion in home health care and hospice funding was suspended, $1.3 billion in California Medicaid reimbursements deferred, and new Medicare hospice enrollments halted until controls improve. audits of Medicaid fraud control units in all 50 states began. 60 million in fraudulent student loan applications were blocked in the first month of enhanced screening. Charges were filed against a Minneapolis daycare owner and in a major Minnesota healthcare fraud scheme involving the highest loss amount and largest autism fraud case in state history. Republicans in Congress are supporting this effort through legislation approved by the U.S. House's Ways and Means Committee. These bills target fraud in Medicare, temporary assistance for needy families, and unemployment insurance. The Protecting Seniors and Stopping Fraudsters Act requires more inspections for new or changing hospices, triples fines for missing quality data, protects patients with enrollment notifications, and holds accrediting organizations accountable. The DME Scanner Prevention Act mandates electronic billing and faster claim submission for high-risk items to enable better detections. The Recover COVID Unemployment Fraud and Banks Act creates a task force to recover nearly $1 billion in frozen fraudulent funds and doubles the statute of limitations to 10 years. The Preventing Waste, Fraud, and Abuse in the TANF Act requires improper payment measurements, sets income thresholds, limits spending periods, and ensures federal funds supplement rather than replace state spending. As midterms approach, this record of action stands in sharp contrast to the failures seen under Democratic control in places like Minnesota. While Trump and Republicans deliver results that preserve taxpayer funds and strengthen programs for eligible Americans, Democrats have shown through the years of neglect what their approach brings: massive scandals, wasted billions, and weakened trust. Voters should remember this clear difference when they head to the polls. Real focus on domestic strength means fighting fraud relentlessly so government serves citizens effectively and efficiently. Trump is following through on his promises, making the government more functional when it matters most for Americans in these trying times. This midterm year, President Trump's relentless war on fraud has already saved billions, restored integrity to safety net programs, and proven that taxpayer dollars belong to American citizens, not criminals or shameful blue states. Minnesota's Democratic nightmare of looted, hard-earned tax dollars stands as a chilling warning. Voters now face a stark choice: reward results that strengthen America or invite the waste and betrayal that spreads like cancer. The decision will echo for generations. Next up, Beware the Renegade Caucus by Alex Rosado, writing in American Spectator. President Trump's golden touch remains undefeated this primary cycle, with every endorsed candidate making it to the November elections. The congressmen he helped oust may soon embark on their own revenge tours. Last month, Kentucky Representative Thomas Massie, Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, and Texas Senator John Cornyn were all outflanked by more Trump-aligned challengers, losing re-election to their respective posts. The three men tangled with Trump before: Massie over the Epstein files and One Big Beautiful Bill, Cassidy on the president's 2021 impeachment, and Cornyn's doubts on Trump 2024 presidential bid, and they made sure to get some digs in on their way out. In his concession speech, Cassidy asserted that he wouldn't pout or whine or claim the election was stolen. Massie expressed, "There is a yearning in this country for somebody who will vote for principles over party." Cornyn posted a pointed frog and scorpion fable on social media, warning against trusting destructive individuals. Although Thomas Massie has filed to run for political office in 2028, immediate re-election incentives are off the table. With the limited time, Cassidy and Massie, with the potential of Cornyn, will likely double down on disruption to the chagrin of the GOP. For them, there's no gain in passing Trump's agenda, so they seem keen to use their final months to defy it and define their legacies instead. In a post-loss interview, Cassidy told viewers that he'd spend his remaining time being the best senator I can possibly be. If being the best means most effective, he may supercharge Senate procedure and his committee authority to cement his break with the president. The two-term senator chairs the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, which oversees many politically sensitive health policy fights, such as drug pricing, vaccine policy, and abortion drug regulation. For instance, he grilled the then Health and Human Services Secretary nominee, RFK Jr., on vaccines in January 25. He tussled with the secretary a few weeks ago on affordability, fraud, abortion medications, and vaccine-preventable disease concerns. Cassidy can also shape or block health nominations, including the ones that would boost RFK Jr.'s plans. He exerted this power by stalling and tanking witnesses wellness influencer Casey Means' chances of becoming the next U.S. Surgeon General earlier this year. Cassie's leverage in Path of Rebellion can force the health portion of Agenda 47 to a crawl. The Magnolia State Senator has already demonstrated that he can use hearings to control the peace and scrutiny of Trump-era personnel, further frustrating Republicans dissatisfied with the nominee gridlock. A physician first, he possesses the knowledge necessary to make these fights technical rather than overtly partisan. Thus, Cassidy may convene hearings that highlight blind spots in the administration's health and education strategies. Coupled with subpoena powers, Cassidy holds the ability to make and sustain public relations episodes for the administration. As 6 out of 10 Americans try to avoid news about Trump, additional unnecessary exposure is not what everybody needs. In another chamber, where a slim majority means every Republican vote matters, Massey can threaten the iron grip on must-pass measures, such as disaster aid, appropriations, and emergency spending. In 2020, Massey tried to force a recorded roll call vote on the $2.2 trillion COVID relief package, delaying the bill and catching Trump's ire. He was one of two House Republicans to vote against Trump's prized 2025 tax and spending package, riled up by the out-of-control national deficit. His high ground is in making surefire legislation contestable, publicly attacking it to cast doubt on why other House Republicans support it. Massey can also transform transparency issues into crest party headaches for Trump's allies. With Democratic Representative Ro Khanna, he forced the release of the Department of Justice's Epstein-related files. Massey also joined Democrats to introduce war powers resolutions to curb Trump's military actions in Venezuela and Iran. In response, the administration went on the defensive, offering explanation for these issues. The Bluegrass State congressman is no stranger to building coalitions on sensitive, timely policy issues. With the Iran war and a ceasefire, and the Epstein documents still unpublished, Massey can capitalize on these trends to combine substance with public embarrassment. Cornyn seems the most unlikely of the bunch to flip on Trump. He voted with Trump 92% of the time during his first term, touting this rate to be 99.2% on his website. Cornyn even introduced a bill last month to rename an interstate highway in honor of the president and reversed his position on the filibuster to help Trump. Cornyn is also a relationship builder with his time as a former majority whip and chairman of the Senate Republican campaign arm, making him a known quantity and dependable ally to GOP officials. President Trump acknowledged Cornyn's ability to make inroads when congratulating Paxton. "John will remain my friend for a long, long time to come," he said, being John Cornyn. If Cornyn decides to forfeit his good standing, his new power could come from behind the scenes. He may refuse to cooperate on further rule changes or signal reluctance to help with special procedures, making it harder for Trump to bypass Senate friction. Relatedly, he may govern inwards, earmarking funds or local projects for Texas rather than partaking in national battles. Cornyn might secure these legacy gifts in exchange for cooperation. With the midterm elections favoring Democrats, Cornyn may convince some Republicans that Trump's asks aren't worth political damage in swing states like Maine. Unlike Cassidy, he can't halt the process, but Cornyn could add drag to issues of personal or political interest. The road to mutiny in this Congress is one already paved by Tom Tillis, the North Carolina senator retiring, in part due to fierce backlash from opposing the One Big Beautiful Bill. Since announcing his departure, Tillis has grown to be a major thorn in Trump's side. He held up Federal Reserve nominees until the administration stopped probing. Fed Chair Jerome Powell called for former Homeland Secretary Kristi Noem's resignation, is now poised to vote against a GOP Border Patrol package. He also blasted the DOJ's new $1.8 billion anti-weaponization fund as a payout pot for punks. A former Cassidy aide assured Politico he won't copy Tillis. However, Cassidy flipped his vote to force President Trump to withdraw from the Iran war, coincidentally, days after Cassidy lost his primary election. Massey appealed skeptical of funding Trump's White House ballroom immediately after his defeat. He later promised to expose more names redacted from the Epstein files. If these actions indicate anything, it's that rabble-rousers are unwavering in deepening the result. Cassidy, Massey, and Cornyn are out, but they aren't leaving without a fight. Cassidy may embrace being a nuisance with institutional weight. Massey can prove that a determined backbencher can still force votes and complicate Trump's messaging. Cornyn, should he choose to go rogue, could use Senate insider tactics to pick and choose fights selectively. These congressional renegades can create visible GOP dissent at exactly the moment Trump and national Republicans need party discipline, a performance that will be remembered far after they leave office. For the sake of GOP in America, let's hope they don't put on a show. And that is a wrap-up for American Spectator and some other journals for this week. I do hope that you have enjoyed listening to these articles as much as I have had in reading them for you. I'll give you a teaser title here. Edward Ring is our author for our next broadcast, and the lead-up article is going to be California's Wealth Tax is Coming for Everyone. So with that teaser, I will say thank you very much for listening. I look forward to bringing you more next week here at the Talking Information Center at the Massachusetts Radio Network. Thank you very much for listening, and have a wonderful day.